Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
I believe united we stand, and we have common ground to find, and we're going to find it. We're not going to be sitting here.
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This is Rewind, this covering this week in the Capitol. First, Wiss I was there. There's $100,000 in the budget to provide mental health counseling to farmers. Joint Finance delayed approving that. Sharp exchange between Representative Tony Kurtz, who's a farmer, and Milwaukee Democrat Jonathan Brostoff on releasing that $100,000. An expert talks about the high levels, lake levels of Lake Michigan, and an EPIC executive talks about the challenges of health, making healthcare records electronic. Wiss I was there.
I have a tremendous respect for Secretary Designee Paff, and I was extremely disappointed in his memo dated the 23rd of July. Basically, once again, saying Republicans have chosen to leave farmers behind. 42% of the counseling vouchers are redeemed. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So there's 58% that are being not used.
Correct.
You know, it might be a matter of fact we're holding that $100,000 back because maybe we want to give you more money because it may be working. But when we hear like 58% aren't being used, no offense, I'm a little bit critical.
The idea of taking $100,000 and from a community that is suffering, I do find very responsible. To those farmers who are not getting that access to that health care, to that mental health treatment because of a power play or whatever's going on in this back and forth, yeah, that matters. Every single life matters. $100,000 is not that much money, especially when we're talking about saving people's lives.
Lake Michigan's water level is significantly higher, 3 to 4 feet higher than it's been in recent past.
Based on science, how does that level of water affect the quality of fishing?
When the water levels go up, you create additional nearshore habitat area. That nearshore habitat area is absolutely critical because that's where eggs are laid. That's where young of year are grown. So it can have pros. It can have positive and negative impacts. But from a biological perspective, you know, it can be positive. From a social perspective, it's pretty negative.
With machine learning, it really boils down to data, and the computer is going to learn from it. It's going to recognize patterns. And really, the value of machine learning hinges on these two concepts here. Data is freely available. It's widely available. From a storage standpoint, from an access standpoint, it continues to get cheaper with software and hardware advancements. But knowledge is scarce. We don't have easy access to it if we're talking about a predictive model that's trained. If we're talking about humans developing expertise, maybe reviewing accounts, maybe looking at a patient's chart, it's very hard to cultivate that expertise. And that's where kind of the real value of machine learning comes in.
Governor Tony Evers enacted 78 vetoes in that budget that the Republican legislature gave him. This week, Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty sued. They filed a direct action bypassing circuit courts, court of appeals, asking that the Supreme Court overturn. Now, JR, here's my question. All 78 vetoes are just the four cited in the press release?
They focused on the four. Interesting, they didn't focus on the one that's the source of the constitutional amendment we can talk about, too.
Right.
But what's interesting is they are arguing that by doing these vetoes, the governor created policy that without approval of the legislature. It's also interesting they're filing this lawsuit now and not when Governor Walker had done it or when Governor Doyle had done it or go back over the years of all these other governors who have done similar things. Now, I can't prepare every veto by veto to what was done, but the argument is we've gone too far. The question is there going to be a limit? Because, look, Evers, I mean, his number of vetoes is like 78.
It's 78.
Below the average the last 30 years. So it wasn't the quantity of what he did. It was kind of what he did. They're arguing, okay, well, to get this overturned, they need to also reverse Supreme Court precedent.
40 years of precedent.
Yes.
Of generally saying that our governor has the strongest veto authority in the nation.
End of story. However, remember, they overturned the Supreme Court we have right now. Well, actually, not quite one because we had a bigger sort of majority as of today.
Yeah.
But that Supreme Court overturned just 3 years of precedent just a few weeks ago. about whether the state superintendent has to submit administrative rules to the governor for approval, right? So we have a different court than we had 40 years ago. So it might be a different outcome this time.
Okay, let's talk about three of these specific vetoes that they challenged. There was a grant program to replace school buses. The governor's vetoes changed that into a $10 million for electric vehicle charging stations. The governor's veto, as we alluded to with Secretary Thompson last week, redirected $90 million to improve local roads into what the lawsuit calls a virtually unrestricted fund, and the governor's vetoes expanded the definition of vapor products in a way that may have affect tax and regulatory authority. Now, he did not challenge the write-up, the additional spending on K-12. Why wasn't that challenged?
Not sure they focused on these because it's policy now. That veto is what's prompted the discussion about a constitutional amendment that prohibit governors from increasing spending beyond what was approved by the legislature. Now, with all of these things going on, the question I've heard from people is, well, is there a chance to come back and bite Republicans in the butt? Because there will be a Republican governor again someday, just question of when, and will he or she then have his or her hands tied because of these proposals, if they, you know, come to bear. So it's something to watch, but it's interesting that it's happened for years. And for Democrats, they see this as a continuing pattern of challenge or going after Tony Evers, trying to undercut his authority, where it's okay for Walker, but not for him. So lame duck session, constitutional amendment, now this lawsuit, they're all trying to, in their minds, Republicans are chafing at Evers having these powers that Walker had.
Right. And before we talk about another major legal development this week, let's hear from the president of Will and the governor's response to this lawsuit challenging his veto. His 78 vetoes of the budget bill, please.
Here we have what I might call a magician's veto, in which appropriation items that have been passed by the legislature have been transformed magically into something else through the clever use of a veto pen. Any governor ought not to be able to use the veto term, the partial veto, to turn an appropriation for buses into one for electrical charging stations, or grants for local roads into grants for local whatever. We're asking the court to reexamine its past cases and to restore our separation of powers by giving our constitutional language its plain meaning, its historical meaning, and to restore our separation of powers.
It's time for our state to move on. We had an election last November, and apparently the Wisconsin Law and Liberty Group doesn't believe that happened, and they're going to continue. So we're getting used to this, so it's no surprise. But frankly, folks, we have to move on. We had an election. We had a budget. We had the budget. It was signed and deliberated by Republicans and Democrats. So I'm ready to move on. Apparently they're not, but the election did happen last November. We're hoping that at some point in time, Will will join that wagon.
Before we talk about our newest Supreme Court justice, we'll get there next. Yesterday afternoon, the Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald put out a press release. He and other Republican leaders have asked the Supreme Court to enforce one of the lame duck laws. Now, am I summarizing it correctly? That law said that before the Attorney General and Department of Justice could settle major cases, Volkswagen et al., they had to get approval from the legislature or joint finance to disperse those settlement funds in the way the DOJ wants. Do I have that right?
Well, a little bit. They have to get in kind of overview, get permission to settle a lawsuit, period. And then once there are settlement funds, they must go to the general fund, not to DOJ.
Okay, thanks.
Now, both with this case and what we saw from Will with the governor's vetoes, they're asking the Supreme Court to take original jurisdiction. Now, the courts don't have to do that. The court can say, no, you're going to go with the lower courts first.
Litigate it first through the circuit court, then court of appeals, then bring it to us.
Yes. It's still not a guarantee they'll take it up. But with this one, what they're saying is that calls inform lawmakers, well, this was not a well-written law, and there are these holes, and because of these holes, I'm not going to apply it to X, Y, and Z. Now, I'm not a lawyer. I don't draft bills for a living, so I can't tell you if it's a well-drafted law or not. Maybe there are holes in it. But they're asking the Supreme Court to say, no, this is what this law means, and Josh Call, you have to adhere to it. Call said, look, you guys didn't draft it properly, and it's basically a poorly worded effort to undercut the DOJ budget. So you know, this is where I think things are.
Okay, and also, for the record, I'm not a lawyer either, but there was a window here where the lame duck laws were struck down mm-hmm. by Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals. So do you think Attorney General Call could say, look, I resolved these settlements in the window when these judges had advised me that the lame duck laws were not valid?
Well, as you read the stuff submitted yesterday, there's actually an exchange between Call and lawmakers kind of detailed where he's saying, look, going forward, this is where I think things are at. So they're saying he's already indicated he's not going to follow this law on these various cases, and we have a problem with that.
Okay, now let's turn to the next subject. We have a new Supreme Court Justice, Brian Hagedorn, who defeated Court of Appeals Judge Lisa Neubauer in April, took in a private ceremony yesterday, mm-hmm. took the oath of office. He's now on the court for a 10-year term. His background, Milwaukee native, Trinity University graduate. He clerked for former Justice Michael Gableman. Then he was chief counsel for Governor Walker, who at a time when Governor Walker drafted at 10, mm-hmm. he was active then in the investigations that exonerated the governor and his supporters. The Governor Walker put him on the Court of Appeals in 2015. And any doubt that he'll join the four conservative justices?
No. It's a solid conservative majority. Now, the thing to watch going forward are, okay, what's this mean? I mean, what's between a 4-3 decision versus 5-2? It's still a conservative majority, but it gives conservatives a cushion because of next spring. We talked before about this with Justice Kelly, another conservative that he faces the prospect of being on the ballot in April 2020 when there's a Democratic primary for president going on. Yeah. That's not a great environment to be on. Now, doesn't guarantee he's going to lose or anything. There are all kinds of variables between now and April. But it guarantees a conservative majority of the court through next spring, which is key because come 2021, guess what we're going to do?
Redistrict.
Where we're going to end up, I don't know, for the state courts or federal courts, but it guarantees a conservative majority on that bench if a redistricting case lands before it for state lines or congressional lines.
To borrow a phrase from the governor, are there dots to be connected here? The Will lawsuit was filed the day before Hagedorn took the oath of office, and the Fitzgerald, the GOP leadership lawsuit filed the day he took office. Dots to be connected?
I don't know if there are dots to be connected, but I mean, it's a conservative majority, and it was before, so this doesn't really change that. It's got another cushion, though, so an extra vote. If you are one of those people who believes that the justices kind of have their minds made up about where they're at philosophically about these things, then yeah, it's makes it easier for conservatives to win some certain stuff.
Yeah, and just a P.S., although the Justice Hagedorn took the oath in a private ceremony yesterday, Wisconsin and I will be covering the public ceremony, his investiture ceremony scheduled for August 14th. Mm-hmm. Okay, now let's talk about the dispute between Speaker Robin Voss and Democratic Representative Jimmy Anderson. There was a lot of words going back and forth, so I just want to summarize from the Speaker's letter yesterday before we talk about the rhetoric, okay? Okay. Well, let's set the table. Representative Anderson, injured and paralyzed in a tragic 2010 accident that killed his parents and his brother, and he said, I'd like to be able to attend committee hearings. I can't make it in person. If I can't make it in person, by phone. And the Speaker yesterday said he cannot change assembly rules. It would take a full vote by the full assembly, but he's willing to set up a videographer, make one available for committee hearings Representative Anderson cannot attend, and have the assembly leadership consider paper ballots that can be cast by other lawmakers when lawmakers are not present. Excuse me. He also said three things I didn't know, summarizing concessions that the assembly had made. They bought a $3,700 digital wireless microphone. They allowed his personal care worker access to the Capitol and the lawmaker's computer, even though the aide is not a state employee. And finally, they reimbursed Anderson's staffer for cab fare every time he drove the lawmaker home. Well, in that letter yesterday, the Speaker accused Representative Anderson of grandstanding. You didn't bring this to me personally. But Representative Anderson, in his response, you want to talk about what he said, how he answered it?
He said he was unnecessarily mean in the tone, paraphrasing a little bit, and that he basically doesn't understand why Rob is taking this position. Now, let's kind of set the table. Go back to 2013. Robin Voss becomes Speaker of the Assembly. We've covered the Capitol for a long time. We remember quite well the days in the Assembly when it even touched the floor until after dinner and then go until 2, 3 o'clock in the morning all the time. Rob wanted to get away from stuff like that. Want to professionalize the environment, kind of bring structure to it. So we had limits on debate. now that we didn't have before. There's a dress code on the floor. They're just things that Robin sees the assembly as like a mini Congress. He wants to mirror kind of how Congress operates. He also has made clear he does not like the option to call into a hearing. In the Senate, you can do that.
Yes.
To Robin, it's disrespectful because somebody comes down the Capitol from wherever they live, testifying a bill, and instead of having, you know, 8, 9, 10 lawmakers there, you've got 9 lawmakers and a phone. To him, that's disrespectful. But in asking people about this issue this week, the response I've gotten back is they don't understand why he's taking a stand on this one situation, because you could make an exception for a lawmaker who is paralyzed in a wheelchair and not for the other 98 members of the assembly.
Yeah.
You could do things that would make this go away. Instead, it's become a national story, and it's a lot of bad headlines for Robin Voss, and they can't figure out why. Why do you want to make this stand? Now, let's be honest. Jimmy Anderson's smart. He's got a great story to tell right now,
yeah,
and he's kind of knocking it out of the park. I mean, he's getting a lot of attention and bringing focus to what's going on in the assembly and creating a very sympathetic story about why won't Robin Voss do this. He's being politically smart with it. Two, Robin said in his letter that you didn't call me about this.
Right.
Well, Anderson
didn't approach me individually, one-on-one. We could have talked about it before you went public. Excuse me.
Leadership negotiates kind of the rules of the chamber session. And so leadership gave me, Dem leadership gave me a proposed, we call it a memorandum of understanding, MOU, that had a provision from Democrats proposing to allow this exception for somebody who had a disability or couldn't make a hearing because of, you know, an impairment. So they raised the issue with Voss, yes, according to this document, and they said no. So again,
is that line in the Voss letter saying you voted against this change for speakerphone?
That's the
Skype. Excuse me.
So again, I mean, we're getting in the weeds of this negotiation, but the bottom line is it's not a good look, and I'm not quite sure why he's taking this stand. I mean, I can understand that he wants to have standards. I can understand that there are people probably in the caucus who think, Republican caucus think, this is being overplayed. We're getting bad headlines, and it's, you know, being blown out of proportion. But still, the consensus has been Democrats and Republicans, why not make this one exception for one person who obviously is different because he has this impairment, he's paralyzed, why not make this exception?
Okay, I'm struck because the Senate already allows members to call in to committee hearings, and the Senate, already allows paper ballots, don't they?
Yes, and Robin said wrote in the letter that they will consider other changes such as allowing paper ballots. Of course, people like us sometimes don't like paper ballots because it means you're not there to see like the exchange about the actual vote.
Yeah, the merits of them.
You wait until 4 o'clock on a Thursday to see like what the vote was, rather than like 10 o'clock hearing. Things like that make it a little bit less fun for the media.
Yeah. Paper ballots are not as transparent as journalists like you and I like.
Yeah, so there are things like that. But again, it's just at this point, I don't know how Robin turns a story around or gets away from it anytime soon.
Okay, now I'm going to go to what I call the for the record topic.
Okay.
There was this vote in Washington. Mm-hmm. The U.S. House voted last week and the Senate voted yesterday. Apparently there's a consensus that the $22 trillion debt, which you and I have interviewed hundreds of candidates saying it's a huge problem. Well, let's push that off. Let's blow off the debt ceiling. Let's increase the spending limit, and then we'll talk about the details of defense spending. But so I'm just intrigued. Voting for 3 Democrats, we have 8 members of the U.S. House and 2 U.S. senators. Voting yes were Democrats, U.S. House member Gwen Moore, U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, U.S. Representative Mark Pocan of Madison. And you have all 5 Republican House members, joined by Ron Kein, voting no. What's it mean, JR?
Majority, minority. I mean, Republicans are the minority in the House. You don't have to support a bill brought up by leadership because, you know, it's just kind of how things work sometimes. So there's that. Maybe that's part of it. Ron Kein, crossing lines. He's a little more of a fiscal moderate. Maybe has issues with the debt and everything else. So, you know, makes sense that he's going to break with leadership once in a while. In the Senate, a little more interesting because you have Ron Johnson, the majority, and Tammy Baldwin, the minority, and Baldwin voted yes and Johnson voted no. I mean, Johnson's raised concerns for years when he's been in the Senate about spending levels, about debt. He also, Democrats will point out, supported the tax cut, which had an offsetting spending cut somewhere else, so why is that? But you saw a break in Washington among Republicans in the Senate of they don't like this deal, because it busts through these spending caps they approved
in 2011.
Yes.
Sequestration.
Yep.
They approved in 2011 after the Tea Party members were elected. which said if we can't get agreement, there will be mandatory spending cuts on this discretionary area. Now, we're not talking about the mandatory costs of Social Security and Medicare. No. We're talking about the discretionary.
Yeah, and don't forget Ron Johnson was kind of birthed by the Tea Party when he ran for U.S. Senate in 2010. Came out of kind of nowhere, the private sector. Remember hearing
spent
about him
$8 million of his own money, personal
gave a
money.
Speech at a Tea Party rally, I think somewhere in his neck of the woods up by Oshkosh, and all of a sudden, bam, he was on the scene and beat Russ Feingold. There are stories in Washington, D.C. this week about how this is the death of the Tea Party. The Tea Party is dead because the whole genesis of it was concerned about spending, right? Government out of control and health care and those kinds of things. Well, now the Tea Party's morphed into the immigration issue part. I'm not sure what the good nickname is for him now, but it's so changed in the span of, 8 years?
But in Washington, Democrats and Republicans can't agree on whether it's night or day. Mm-hmm. And on this one, they agreed, and the president said, I hope my members of my party vote for it because it protects military spending and helps our veterans.
It also takes the debt issue off the plate ahead of 2020, which is part of what the president wanted too, right? Not have that, or never mind that the debt ceiling was something that, different story. Funny how when whoever's in power, kind of like the story changes about things like this, doesn't it?
Right. Very, very true. Okay, big discussion this week on water issues in several ways. But let's open with the governor talking about his water initiatives, and then we'll come back and put some specifics on that. Please.
I'm announcing that we are moving forward with another very important step to protect the public's right to clean drinking water by addressing nitrate contamination from agriculture runoff. Our farmers are showing us that we can take steps to change the way we farm and take a great big step towards clean water. I'm directing the Department of Natural Resources to pursue rulemaking known as NR 151 to reduce nitrate contamination by establishing targeted nitrate performance standard for soils that are most likely to experience nitrogen contamination. The Department of Health Services have identified that lead-poisoned children exist in every county in Wisconsin. The good news is that lead exposure obviously can be preventable. The bad news is the legislature did not do well enough in the budget to fund our efforts to tackle this crisis. Today, I'm signing an executive order that directs state agencies to spearhead an effort to inform and protect Wisconsinites against public health risks that happen because of lead poisoning.
The governor ordered two state agencies to establish standards on nitrates. Mm-hmm. I think he wants that was in 18, 24 months.
30-ish?
30, thank you. Sorry. And he signed an order creating a Department of Health coordinator to fight lead levels in water that threaten children's health. Now, the background of that, he proposed $40 million to help replace lead laterals that link municipal systems to homes, and the Republicans said, no way. And the governor, as you just heard, said there is lead in drinking water in all Wisconsin counties. And he also encouraged Milwaukee residents to take back their unused prescription drugs and put them in drop boxes. And he also yesterday, executive order declared it the month of clean water. Now, but I'm struck by today's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel story that 32 of 35 wells in southwest Wisconsin, specifically Grant, Iowa, and Lafayette counties, were tested and found to contain fecal elements either from animals or humans. This water issue just keeps getting bigger, doesn't it?
Yeah. A couple things here. Evers is one, reminding people of what he wanted to do more in the budget than Republicans allowed him. So there's that. Two, to seem proactive about the water issue. And remind people that, this cuts across party lines. It cuts across geographical lines. We have different issues in different areas, right? We've got we've got southwest Wisconsin with Cami Wells. We've got CAFOs, confined animal feeding operations up in the Kewaunee area.
Kewaunee.
It turns about manure leaking into groundwater. We've got lead laterals over in Milwaukee and other places where they stressed. I mean, it is a more complex issue than many people realized a few years ago, and it strikes a chord with people. They all want to be able to trust the water coming off the tap. It's pretty simple. Yeah. And if you don't trust it, you want to fix.
I'm beginning to think that water is going to become the biggest issue of this year. And previous to this, I thought it would be Foxconn. What do you think? What do you think on that?
I don't know. We'll see.
Okay. All right. Let's go to your stock report. Rising.
So rape charges. So we had DOJ announced nine charges.
That's your stock pick. I'll
that's
be quiet.
Okay. We can commit a little bit. So nine charges filed because they tested rape kits and matched them to folks, and away we go. It's interesting with this issue and talking to people that here's an announcement, good news, right? But there's this kind of political subtext of Brad Schimmel got knocked the crap out of because this backlog hadn't been fixed right away in his administration. He got on top of it late, some would say.
Last 18 months of his administration.
Eliminated it, and now Josh Call, who beat him up over the issue, is reaping the benefits announcing these charges. I mean, yeah, things were called a watch before. He's got to keep on top of this issue, keep working it, and those kinds of things. But it's kind of fascinating to watch that dynamic play out where you've got that going on where here's a guy who put this work in, again, possibly late. Now this guy's going to get to
benefits. And I think the charges, the nine charges filed this week brings a total of 35.
35 cases, I think, were referred for prosecution, something like
that. Yep, right. Okay, mixed?
So redistricting. So, like, it's a slow time in the Capitol right now, okay, let's be honest.
Okay, you're going to the rumor. All right, go ahead.
So I'd heard this rumor a few weeks ago about Republicans are going to look for a way to go around Tony Evers and redistricting. This is the process of drawing new lines every 10 years. So the election of Evers is so important for Democrats, not just because, you know, they beat Walker, but because it gave them guaranteed seat at the table in 2021 to draw lines, which meant Republicans couldn't draw them on their own. So either they had to make an agreement, unlikely, or goes to courts, which Democrats were, hey, we're getting a better deal no matter what, because if it was Walker Republicans again, they're not getting a better deal.
Right.
Now there's this rumor that they go to what's called a joint resolution. It does not require a governor's signature, and you would pass maps via that. Now, I heard it from a Democrat, had a chance to like really dig into it. Scott's Examiner, new publication, kind of a progressive publication, wrote a story about this idea has been floated. And again, it might be slow in the Capitol, but it kind of caught fire for 2 days of like, well, would they really do this? And both Speaker Voss and Senator Fitzgerald said, we've not had conversations about this. The natural follow-up
is key, not had any conversation about this.
The natural follow-up is, will you rule out doing this? Nothing came back.
Silence back.
Now, again, you know, maybe that's not a big deal. Maybe this is just wild rumor. But if Democrats are basically paranoid because they look at what's happened in the last few years, right? Look, the maps that were drawn in 2011 really were great for Republicans. I mean, there are other factors. Like, there's money, message, quality of candidates going into this. But Republicans have maximized their ability to do all these maps. That was an issue. Then you had the December lame duck session, right? Undercut Evers and Call. Now you've got these other things, like these constitutional amendments about the veto, the lawsuit from Will. There's a paranoia among Democrats of what will they do next? You know, we finally got this break with Evers. What will they do next? And, you know, I don't know if it's going to go anywhere. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. My guess is we're going to end up in court one way or another in 2021 about the lines.
Right.
And don't forget, there was a Supreme Court decision in 1964, I think, that said, Republicans, you can't do a joint resolution. A Democrat governor at the time, a Republican legislature, you can't do joint resolution on maps. They have to go through the normal process. But again, that's a different court 50 years ago.
That's true.
Now what? And that's the thing. Again, just maybe it's a capital rumor, but it's just something to watch.
Okay, you got 40 seconds on your falling.
Farmers, it's been fascinating to watch this whole thing about farmer mental health. I mean, it's been a terrible run for farmers. Weather, crop prices, tariffs, everything's kind of working against them. There's an issue about farmer mental health, money to address that. It's now in the Joint Finance Committee. Evers administration is saying release it. Joint Finance is saying, no, we're going to, and Republicans say, no, we're going to go through this task force and kind of talk about mental health as a whole. And it's become this, like, war back and forth of, like, shot after shot from the debt cap secretary saying this was a bad thing to do, Fitzgerald saying that was childish that you said those kind of comments. I mean, they're getting caught in this crossfire of a political battle.
And we're America's Dairyland?
Yes,
do I
we
have
are.
This correct? Okay, I want to ask you one more thing quickly. Morning Story and Politico. They have Sensenbrenner on the retirement watch list. Your reaction?
I don't know who they're talking to, but not the people I talk to.
Not the people you talk to.
No.
He's only been there. He's elected in 78. He's serving his 41st year. You've not heard that.
The people I talk to think that Mr. Sensenbrenner will serve in that office as long as he possibly can.
Thank you. I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
That's Rewind for August 2.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.